This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
You're listening to live courtroom coverage of the trial of Karen Reed from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
You have joined the meeting as an attendee and will be muted throughout the meeting. The host would like you to unmute your mic. You are unmuted.
Please be seated. Court is in session.
Good morning.
Good morning. For the record, before the court is Commonwealth versus Karen Reed, 22 CR117. The parties are present. The jury is not present. The matter is on for trial.
Thank you. So, good morning. I heard the counsel wanted to see me about something.
Yes, please.
All right. Why don't you come on over to sidebar?
All right.
You. You are unmuted.
All right, why don't counsel come on down? Yes, please.
This should be 1 minute.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we are entering. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having anything to do before the Honorable Beverly Cannoni, the Justice of the Superior Court, hold it in denim within and for the County of Norfolk. Draw near, give your attendance, and you shall be heard. God save the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. This court is in session. Please be seated.
For the For the record, before the court is Commonwealth versus Karen Reed, 22 CR117. The parties are present. Our 18 jurors are present. The matter is on for trial.
Thank you very much, Madam Clerk. Good morning again, counsel. Good morning again, Ms. Reed.
Good morning, jurors.
Good morning.
When we leave you out there, we're very much aware that we're leaving you in another room waiting, but we were working this morning to help streamline things, and we were successful, so we do appreciate your patience. I do have to ask you those questions. Were you all able to follow the instructions and refrain from discussing this case with anyone since we left yesterday?
Yes.
Everyone nodded affirmatively or said yes. Were you also able to follow the instructions and refrain from doing any independent research or investigation into this case? Everyone said yes or nodded affirmatively. Did any of you happen to see, hear, or read anything about this case since we left yesterday?
No.
Thank you. Everyone said no. All right, folks, as you know, this morning we are going on a view. And a view is simply, we're going to a place that you've heard about and that you will continue to hear about during the course of the trial. The purpose of the view is to help you better understand the evidence which you'll hear during the course of the trial and to help you appreciate the location and its surroundings. So the view that we're going on is part of the case, and it means that the observations that you make there can be used and considered by you in your deliberations on this case in reaching a verdict. So we're going to, you've heard, 34 Fairview Road in Canton. The lawyers and I will accompany you. For the Commonwealth, we'll be accompanied by Attorney Brennan and ADA Lally, ADA Schillinger, and for the defense, Attorney Iannetti and Attorney Little. The lawyers will have the opportunity, Mr. Iannetti and Mr. Brennan, have the opportunity to point out various things that they may want you to direct your attention to. Otherwise, there's no conversation between the lawyers and the jurors. So it's simply in a few minutes you'll hear a little bit from each Mr. Brennan and Ms. Iannetti about what they want you to look at. And then when we get there, they'll direct you, look in this direction. They won't be able to testify to you, but they'll direct you in what they want you to look at. While you're in the view, you're not to take any notes, you're not to take any pictures, you're not to conduct any independent investigation at all during the view or any time during the trial. You're not to return to this scene or ask anybody to go back there for you. Today's your chance. You'll see photographs during the course of the trial, I bet. But today's your chance to really look at everything. So the best way to summarize a view is that your job is to simply stop and look. It's really no more complicated than that. So your responsibility is to see the place, observe it carefully, and to remember what you see. Now, during the trip to and from the view, and while at the view, you're not to discuss this case or anything about it with other jurors. We'll be accompanied by court officers who will direct you, and the court officers are there for all of us. So you'll be under their supervision until you're returned back here. So that's basically it. We'll be leaving in a few minutes, but first, before Madam Clerk swears the court officers in, Mr. Brennan, do you want to make a view opening?
May I?
Please.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
Good morning, Your Honor.
As Her Honor explained to you, we're going to go to 34 Fairview Road. We have some exhibits that are already in evidence. You haven't had a long time to look at them and study them. But essentially, we're going to go to 34 Fairview Row. I ask you just to pay attention to the street, the front yard of the home. And you'll see to the left side of the front yard in the corner, there'll be a car. It's the Lexus that we've spoken about, the defendant's Lexus. And you'll also see a flagpole and a fire hydrant. And so I'd ask you to take a look from different vantage points. Take a look from that area where the flagpole is, from where the fire hydrant is. And you'll see on the street before the grass is a little firm, concrete that comes up a little bit. I'd ask you just to note that when you go there. One thing I'd suggest is April 25th, 2025, not January 22nd, 2022. So the weather will be very different. The temperature will be different. The conditions will be different. We're going to go there probably at 10 o'clock. It won't be the same visibility. It won't be the same elements and the same weather. So keep that in mind when you're looking around. When you look at the Lexus, there's a couple of things I'd ask you to look at. There is some evidence already in of photographs of the right rear taillight. When you look at that taillight, it will be different than the photograph that is in evidence. It has been removed, so it will appear differently, and you'll later hear testimony explaining that process. Also, I'd ask you to make a note on the Lexus about the height of the bumper. I'd ask you to make note of the height of the right rear taillight. And I'd also ask you to take note of, on the top of the hatchback, there is a part that protrudes. I'd ask you to take a look at that as well. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Brennan. Ms. Tianetti?
Thank you, Ron.
Good morning. Good morning. As I told you at the start of the trial, my name is David Tianetti. I have an office in Boston and in Denver. And on behalf of my co-counsel, we will be accompanying you on the view that you will take today. Although the view is not evidence, I suggest to you that you will find it to be helpful, important, even necessary, as you later do your investigation of this case within the four walls of this courtroom. You've already received into evidence, you know, some photos and videos, but there is no substitute for your own two eyes. As we all know, photos and videos sometimes can be misleading in terms of relative distances, depending upon the perspective from which the photo is taken. But your eyes are the best computer that you could bring to the view. When we get to 34 Fairview, we will be pointing out certain things that we'd like you to observe. The house, second floor window, to that house, the three front doors in the front of the house, the driveway, the street, the front lawn, and the flag pole. And we'll be asking you specifically to consider the distance between that second floor front window and the front lawn, the distance between the front doors to the house and that front lawn, the distance between the driveway to the front lawn. And we'll be asking you to take a good look at that Lexus. To stand next to it. To size it up. To take it in. You were all selected as jurors because the parties entrusted that you would do a proper investigation of this case within this courtroom. On behalf of Ms. Reed, we have every confidence that you will do a proper investigation. Thank you.
All right, jurors, I have to make something very clear. So the purpose of this view is to help you better to understand the evidence that you'll hear during the trial and to help you appreciate the location and its surroundings. The view you'll take is part of this case. The observations that you make while on the view may be used and considered by you in your deliberations in reaching a verdict. So at the end of the trial, when I explain to you what is evidence and what is not, I'll remind you that your observations on this view can be used by you in your deliberations. Also, while you're in the view, the same way you're not to take any notes or photographs, you're not to conduct any investigation on this case. You really are simply to stop and look, okay? Those are the instructions. We will see you in a few minutes. All right, thank you. Oh, sorry, Madam Clerk has to swear in the court officers.
If you could all raise your right hand, please. Do each of you solemnly swear that you will take the jury upon the premises in question and there suffer them to view the same or any property, place, or thing bearing upon the issue in the trial as the parties may think necessary, that you will not permit the parties to enter into a debate in the hearing of the jury, nor any person to speak to them unless it be the attorneys of record, then only to point out such places or things as they may deem expedient for the determination of the issues, that you will keep them the jury together until they shall return to court, unless the court shall otherwise order, so help you God. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
All right, please, just follow me.
Goodbye.
is back in session. You may be seated.
Who is your next witness?
You're on the call. I'm going to call Dr. Gary Fowler to the stand.
Thank you.
Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you shall give to the court and the jury in the matter now pending shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? Thank you.
Sure. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning. Good morning, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Lally, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Could you please introduce yourself to the jury, spelling your last name for the court?
My name is Dr. Gary Fowler, Epison Frank, A-L-L-E-R.
And what is your occupation?
I am a physician pathologist.
And where do you work?
I work currently at Signature Healthcare in Brockton.
And how long have you worked at Signature, and in what capacity, sir?
Signature, I started, it's probably 6 months. I took a new job 6 months ago. I've been, I am the chief of pathology and the laboratory medical director at Signature.
And where did you work prior to your work at Signature about 6 months ago?
Prior to that, I was at Good Samaritan Medical Center in the same capacity.
And how long did you work at Good Samaritan for?
Since 2015, late 2015.
And did you work in any capacity similar to that prior to working at Good Samaritan?
Prior to Good Samaritan, I worked at the Kearney Hospital, which is in Dorchester. Started that job in 1996. So I stayed on staff at Kearney Hospital up until actually closed 6 months ago. So I've been on staff at Kearney for quite a long time.
Where did you go to school, and what degrees did you receive?
I went to college at Tufts University in Medford, graduated in AD 7. From there, I went to Tufts Medical School and graduated in 1991.
And following your graduation, where did you go from there?
After medical school, I did a residency at Tufts Medical Center in 1991 to 1996.
And then where did you go following your residency?
And right from residency, I start my first job was at Kearney Hospital, which I previously mentioned, so 1996.
And doctor, are you board certified?
I am board certified in anatomic pathology and clinical pathology.
And what is a board certification?
Board certification is something we need to show that we are actually qualified to perform our the job that we need to do, both in anatomic and clinical pathology. It's a written exam that we take and we need to pass. To show, demonstrate that we're competent and know what we're doing.
First, in just general terms, if you could explain to the jury, what is pathology?
Pathology is, there are two basic branches of pathology, anatomic pathology and clinical pathology. Anatomic pathology is basically an anatomic pathologist is a physician or MD or a DO trained to make diagnoses on patients via looking at tissue biopsies, organs, tissue fluids, and we're also trained at in autopsy pathology as well. So basically, an anatomic pathologist, we look at tissues via glass slides. Slides are made. And we every day make the diagnosis of, you know, somebody has a cancer or somebody doesn't have a cancer, benign, look at colon polyps, breast biopsies, pretty much anything that comes out of the operating room or a physician's office, any sort of biopsy. Clinical pathology, on the other hand, is basically a clinical pathologist is a physician, an MD or a DO, who specializes in the clinical lab, which basically is any fluid specimen, including blood specimens. When you go to the hospital and you have your blood test and it gets sent to the lab, the clinical pathologist is ultimately responsible for the quality of that, of your lab tests and quality, and basically that, you know, that's it.
And so the time that you worked at Good Samaritan, did that cover the date of January 29th, 2022?
Yes.
And again, what was your title and what was your job at Good Samaritan in the month of January 2022?
I was the chief of pathology at the time and laboratory medical director.
And what did you do as the laboratory medical director?
Laboratory medical director, the laboratory medical director is responsible for the ultimate quality of any, either whether it's a biopsy, somebody's biopsy, or lab result. The laboratory medical director has to make sure that the final result is of excellent quality. So there are many different things that we need to make sure that things that are in place, as far as need to make sure we have the correct amount of workers. You want to have enough workers. You want to make sure they're competent. So as many, there are policies for competency for all the lab techs and phlebotomists and even pathologists. So basically the laboratory medical director, if something goes wrong, it's ultimately his or her fault.
And the lab at Good Samaritan, is that lab accredited?
Yes, it is.
And by what body?
We are accredited, or Good Samaritan is accredited by the, we call it the CAP. It's a College of American Pathologists. They are considered the preeminent accrediting body for hospitals. They've been around for probably 70 plus years or so.
What is accreditation? What does that mean?
Accreditation is basically something that says that your laboratory is following guidelines and providing excellent quality. To be accredited with the CAP, every 2 years we have a laboratory inspection. They don't tell you when they're coming. They will give you a 3-month window and they'll come and inspect you to make sure we are have a good quality lab. Each section of the lab, pathology, the clinical lab, microbiology, chemistry, hematology, the CAP has a checklist with numerous requirements that one needs to fulfill. There are probably over 3,000 items that that they look at.
And was your laboratory at Good Samaritan, was the accreditation up to date on January 29th, 2022?
We were accredited, still are.
Now, in Good Samaritan Medical Center, when a blood test is ordered, what types of things is the lab testing for?
I think the most common tests that are performed when you go and you have your blood tests is one is a chemistry test, where we sodium, potassium, chloride, glucose. We also a common test is a CBC, or a complete blood count, where we look at your red blood cells and your white blood cells and your platelets. Those are the two most common tests.
And why is blood testing ordered in the course of medical treatment at a hospital?
When you're admitted to the hospital, usually you're sick, so the physician is usually a standard, you know, ordering chemistry and CBC to see if there are any clues in those tests that could help the doctor take care of you. You know, if they look at a BUN and creatinine, maybe if they're elevated, you either could it be dehydrated or have renal failure. If you look at liver function tests, maybe there's something wrong with your liver. So it's just a general a good look at the patients to see if there are any clues that could help them.
And as far as the blood testing results are concerned, how does that assist either a doctor or a clinician in treatment and diagnosis?
Basically, what I just said, if the results are normal, that sometimes helps too. Rules things out if they're normal. If they do a CBC and look at the hemoglobin and it's low and patient's anemic, maybe the patient might need a transfusion. So there are many different case scenarios where the results can help the provider, the clinician.
Now, with reference to alcohol, does the Good Samaritan Medical Center, do they also test alcohol within the blood?
Yes, we do.
And why would that assist medical treatment and diagnosis?
I think if a physician is wanting to know if somebody's been drinking or has alcohol on board, or maybe not, maybe a patient has ingested maybe drugs of abuse. So they'll test for alcohol to see, one, if it's positive. And if it is, then it helps confirm that the patient has been drinking.
Now, are there any policies and protocols at Good Samaritan Medical Center with reference to how blood is taken and how blood is tested?
Yes, we have numerous policies. We have one policy specifically for phlebotomists. Those are laboratory technicians who draw the blood. So we have a policy for them to explain exactly what they need to do. And also in the laboratory, we have numerous policies basically for any tests that we provide. And so we have a policy for alcohol testing as well.
May I approach the witness, Your Honor?
Yes.
Doctor, I'm placing before you two sets of documents. Just ask you to review those generally and look up when you're finished. And do you recognize what those are, sir?
Yes.
And can you explain to the jury what is contained within each of those two sets of documents?
Okay. The first one is a patient preparation for specimen collection. This is the policy that I was mentioning, specifically designed for our phlebotomist to detail the procedure of the blood draw. Basically, goes through one of the most important parts of the process is correct patient identification, where we need I correctly identify the patient. We have the patient state his or her first and last name and state it out loud to make sure it matches which the patient that we're trying to draw. And then we also match up the bracelet to the medical record number on the patient's bracelet. So one of the most important things is correct patient identification. The rest of this policy goes on and just pretty much details what to do next, including finding the veins, cleaning the site, has some information on if there are any complications. So it's basically the entire process of the blood draw. The second one is our alcohol policy, which pretty much details in detail what goes on behind the scenes for an alcohol blood test in our hospital.
May I approach again, Your
Honor? Yes.
Your Honor, call off and seek to introduce and admit us the next two exhibits.
No objection. All right, thank you.
Your Honor, for the record, it would be the patient preparation for specimen collection. The next exhibit in line.
All right. Exhibit
35. And the ETOH policy would be the next exhibit number 37.
Thank you. Exhibit 36.
Excuse me.
Thank you.
Now, doctor, what types of precautions are in place at Good Samaritan with respect specifically to alcohol testing in the blood? Or I should say taking the blood sample from the patient.
Yes, one of the major things we need to do with taking somebody's blood for alcohol is to obviously not use an alcohol swab. Normally, when you have your blood test, they cleanse the area with a swab that contains alcohol. So in our policy is a specific statement that says, do not use alcohol swab because potentially, when you're drawing the blood, if you suck up some of that residual alcohol, you could cause a false positive. So we have in our policy, and it's every hospital should have the same policy where we use a swab that has no alcohol. We call them a moist towelette. That's what we refer them to. Also in the emergency room, my supervisor pretty much removed probably 95% of all the alcohol swabs. So just in case a phlebotomist forgets to not use an alcohol swab, they are hard to find. We need to keep a few there because we need to use alcohol wipes on certain tests like blood cultures and stuff like that. So,
when were the alcohol swabs removed from the emergency department?
It was before my time.
So fair to say prior to January 29th, 2022?
Correct.
What is a phlebotomist and what do they do?
So a phlebotomist is a healthcare professional who specializes in drawing blood. So they're the ones who are trained, competent, and know what to do when they draw a patient's blood.
What kind of training do phlebotomists receive at Good Samaritan?
We try to hire phlebotomists who have been trained. It's just easier. So they come, they can have a high school background, but if we train on site, they just need to be trained on, you know, the proper protocol, proper procedures, and demonstrate competency.
Is there any sort of proficiency testing related to phlebotomists at Good Samaritan?
There is no proficiency testing for phlebotomists, but there's competency assessments. So with phlebotomists or any laboratory technician or even pathologists, there are strict guidelines for competency. We have to always make sure people know what they're doing, and it's a CLIA or a federal government regulation or requirement. So when anybody first starts in a hospital, the requirements are, one, initial training. You can't let anybody come in on their own, you know, without not knowing what they're doing. So we have to document that they have the initial training and they're competent. And then the law says 6 months from that, we do another competency assessment where we look at six elements of competency defined by CLIA. And 6 months from that, 1 year from the start date, is another competency. And then after that, it's annual thereafter. And that goes for phlebotomists, and then it goes for any laboratory technician.
Doctor, once the blood is drawn by the phlebotomist, what happens then?
So the phlebotomist will draw it at the time. They need to have the specimens labeled in the patient's room because you don't want the phlebotomist to mislabel. So everything gets labeled at the patient's bedside with an initialed and with a phlebotomist initial and date and times. That blood test will then be sent to the lab. In this case, the blood was drawn in the emergency room, so it gets packaged into a plastic bag and sent in a pneumatic tube up to the laboratory.
And once it's sent to the laboratory, what happens with the sample from there?
Once we receive it, it's called receiving the specimen. There will be a technician who then goes into the computer, enters the phlebotomist's name from the tube into the computer system, enters the time, and the technologist will look and see what was ordered, and then do the appropriate next step based on what was ordered.
And in a case in which alcohol is one of the items that are ordered, what is the next step as far as the testing goes?
So the next step with alcohol testing, we use a specific tube so the phlebotomist would know what tube to use. It would be a light green tube that has lithium heparin in it. It's an anticoagulant. We don't want the blood to clot, so that's why we use an anticoagulant. So the first step when testing for alcohol is that the test is designed to be performed on serum or plasma. And to get that, the next step would be to centrifuge the blood. A centrifuge is machine that spins the blood rapidly. We spin it at around 3,300 RPMs, which is pretty fast, rotations per minute. And the reason why we spin it, because centrifugation will allow it to separate the blood components based on the density. So heavier stuff, like the red blood cells, will go to the bottom, and the lighter stuff, like the watery component of the blood, will go to the top, and some of the white cells go into the middle. But we, for alcohol testing, we are targeting the top part of the blood component, which would be plasma.
And then once it goes through the centrifuge process, what happens then?
So once it's centrifuged, we have the separation of the blood components. We have the plasma ready to be tested, so that technologist will walk the specimen over. It's probably 10 feet from there, and put it onto our Roche Cobas machine. That's our machine that performs our chemistries, as well as alcohol testing. It goes on to a machine. All the testing is basically inside of a black box. And the label present on the blood tube will dictate what the Roche machine will test. So based on the barcode label, once it's on our machine, it knows what test to do, and it will perform an alcohol test.
And Dr. Ford, our stenographer, do you know how to spell that Roche Cobas machine that you were just referencing?
Oh, R-O-C-H-E, Roche, and Cobas, C-O-B-A-S.
Thank you, sir. May I approach, Ron?
Yes.
Doctor, showing you another series of documents again. If you can just look at that and look up on your bench. Do you recognize those records, sir?
Yes.
And what do you recognize those to be?
These are the medical records of Karen Reed.
And sir, is there an indication within those records as far as the date of treatment for Ms. Reed?
Yes, there's a bunch of dates in here.
As far as the treatment is concerned, sir?
Yes.
And yep, what is the date of treatment?
Oh. 1-9-22.
Sorry, is that 29-22?
That's what it says on this. Admit date, it says 1/29/22.
Thank you, sir. That's fine. Doctor, if I could direct your attention further into the document to a previously tabbed portion, do you see any indication in there as far as a result for alcohol testing?
Yes, I do.
And with respect to that result, have you reviewed these records prior to today?
Yes, I did.
And if you could explain to the jury sort of the timeline from this blood sample as far as, let's start with first when it was ordered.
So when it was ordered, it was 9:03 in the morning.
Okay. And when was it taken, sir?
The blood test was taken 5 minutes later, so 9:08.
And then what happened, or what is the next time that something of any significance happened with it?
5 minutes from that, 9:13, we received it, and 9:53 in the morning, the result was entered into the computer. So it was ordered at 9:03. And I believe it was 9:53, the results were in the computer.
And may I approach again, Your Honor?
Yes.
I'm about to seek to introduce and admit as the next exhibit.
Any objection, Ms. Little?
No objection.
All right, thank you.
Exhibit 37.
Your Honor, may I return to the doctor this
morning? Yes.
And doctor, what was the result of the testing for alcohol in the defendant's blood when it was taken shortly after 9 a.m. on January 29th?
93 milligrams per deciliter.
Thank you, sir. Nothing further, Your Honor.
Okay. Ms. Little?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Dr. Fowler.
Oh, good afternoon.
The Good Samaritan Lab is a clinical lab, not a forensic lab. Is that right?
Correct.
And hospitals are not in the legal business of calculating an individual's blood alcohol concentration. Is that right?
I would say 99.9% of the time we are not in the legal business. We are testing alcohol for the diagnosis of alcohol intoxication. But occasionally a case may come, very rare, to a hospital and it ends up being a legal case. It's not common, I think uncommon.
Can you agree that there are differences between screening tests that are conducted at hospitals and forensic tests that are conducted by law enforcement, right?
Yes.
The purpose of testing in a clinical setting is to assist in the diagnosis and treatment of a patient, right?
Correct.
And physicians need to analyze blood quickly. They need to get the results so they can see what's in a patient's system and then effectively and efficiently treat that patient, right?
Correct.
Whereas in a forensic setting, tests for blood alcohol concentration are designed to produce results that are reliable and credible for use in court. Correct?
Correct.
You testified earlier today that your lab is accredited by CAP, which is the College of American Pathologists. Do you recall that testimony?
Yes, I do.
But CAP is a clinical laboratory accreditation, not a forensic accreditation, right?
We don't have the forensic accreditation for Good Samaritan.
In fact, Good Samaritan has never been investigated or accredited by any forensic accreditation team.
to ensure that you perform all of your tests with the integrity necessary to support results in court, right?
We've never had the forensic accreditation, but we have very good quality lab results, which I could go into further.
But you've never been accredited by a forensic accreditation team, right?
Nope.
And the lab at Good Samaritan has never been accredited by the ANSI, which is the National Accreditation Board, known as ANAB. Are you familiar with that organization?
No.
Are you aware that ANAB is the forensic accreditation body that in the United States that ensures that laboratories' procedures meet the minimum standards necessary to ensure results are reliable and credible for use in court?
Objection.
Sustained.
Now, the most reliable method of forensic ethanol testing is called headspace gas chromatography, or HSGC. Are you familiar with that process?
Yes.
And HSGC is the method that's used by forensic labs to test for blood alcohol content, right?
Correct.
And that's because forensic tests require the testing of whole blood for the presence of alcohol, right?
Correct.
Can you briefly, just for the jury, describe sort of the difference between a whole blood test and a serum test?
Sure. So whole blood, to put it simply, when you have your blood drawn, you see the fluid coming out all red. That's whole blood. We don't do anything to it. We don't spin it down. We don't centrifuge it. That is whole blood. That is the specimen of choice for forensic blood ethanol testing. Hospitals, on the other hand, our methodology, which is just as good as the forensic headspace gas chromatography, is based on looking at the serum or the plasma. So we don't, that's what I went when I explained that we need to centrifuge it, take the liquid portion off the top. So in the hospital, we test it on the serum or the plasma. Now, did you ask me the difference? Do you want me to go into the difference?
That's enough, Doctor. Thank you. I'll ask some additional questions to kind of clarify. In a forensic lab, they actually require the testing of whole blood, correct?
Correct.
And HSGC directly measures ethanol in the blood.
Correct.
And this method is designed to be accurate and reliable for forensic purposes for use in legal proceedings, correct?
Correct.
But the testing in this case was performed using the hospital's clinical chemistry machine instead of a forensically defensible method like HSGC, right?
Correct.
And that clinical chemistry machine performs what you just testified to, a serum test, right?
Serum or plasma.
Serum or plasma. And hospitals use serum or plasma testing because it's actually quicker and more efficient than HSGC, right?
Yes, it's less labor intensive, it's easy to automate, but at the same time, very, very good and very accurate.
But serum testing does not actually measure alcohol directly. It instead measures the presence of what's called NADH, right?
Can you say that again?
Yes, I'll repeat that. That was my fault. Serum testing does not actually measure alcohol directly. Instead, it measures the presence of NADH. Is that right?
Almost.
Well, NADH is a byproduct of alcohol, right?
Correct. I can go into the testing methodology that we use to explain it if you want me to.
Well, serum testing measures the presence of NADH, correct?
It measures the rate of change of NADH production, so it doesn't actually look at just NADH, and it measures the rate of production, and I can go into more detail on that. Alcohol testing in the lab is correct.
I'll ask you some additional questions about NADH and we'll get there.
Yep.
So you can do this now, but let the doctor answer his question fully, next question, okay? And the following questions.
Doctor, the higher the NADH in a patient's system, the higher the serum test result, correct?
That may not be correct, no. It's the rate of change of NADH production based on our methodology. I can go into that. So our test system is a little bit different than the forensic testing system, but it's also very good and very accurate, and almost when we compare our methodology to the Headspace, we get the exact same results, and when we compare and with peer laboratory comparisons. But what we do is what this, and I think the jury needs to know this, maybe some of you might understand the chemistry behind it, we take the patient's sample, and it's based on, we add, because this, when there's alcohol in the specimen, we add, actually, in the test system, alcohol dehydrogenase. It's the same enzyme that's in the patient's body. In addition, we add a surplus of NAD to it. NAD is similar to NADH. They get converted back and forth. So when we put it on our test system, it's alcohol dehydrogenase is in there, and what happens is, when there's alcohol, it combines with NAD that we add to it. It creates NADH. And then in our machine, there's a spectrophotometer, which can monitor the rate of NADH production over baseline. And we use, there's something that measures, a photometer that measures the NADH production. It looks at light in this physics and looks at 340 nanometers, and it's pretty accurate. It will monitor, it will tell you, print, give you, a, it will tell the system how much NADH is produced, and that amount is directly proportional to the alcohol in the patient's sample. So it's a very, very accurate test. But there are some limitations that I can go into.
So wait for another question.
Okay.
Next question, Ms. Little.
Yes, so serum testing can be subject to errors, right? And there are limitations.
There are some limitations that I can explain, just like Headspace gas chromatography may have some limitations too. But I can go into them.
Next question.
What are some of the limitations of the serum testing?
Okay. So the serum test, as with many tests in the laboratory, different things can interfere with our laboratory tests. And the three most common ones, which are unlikely to affect ethanol testing, is we abbreviated HIL. We want to look at those three things. One is hemolysis, which is H, and the other one is I, icterus, which is high bilirubin, and the third is L for lipids. High lipids will interfere with alcohol testing or with any testing based on that same methodology. Our machine, the Roche Cobash machine, and all the machines out in the market today are very sophisticated. If we have elevated levels of any H or I or L, it will flag it and raise the potential for a problem. The next thing on the list is that our alcohol testing is not absolutely specific for ethanol. There are two possible other alcohols that can cross-react. One is propanol and butanol. But then it goes clinical history. Did the patient ingest those two alcohols? And third is there's some unusual hematologic malignancies like Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia that can interfere. So it's always have to correlate with the clinical situation. The next one, sometimes there can be patients who make endogenous make their own alcohol. So very rarely some patients may truly have a positive result. That could be from our test or Headspace. They make their own. So we have to rule that out. That's a rare condition. And the next one is one that's in the literature, which is LDH and lactic acid. If a patient has a markedly elevated LDH or lactic acid, one is an enzyme, and the other one is an acid, that can cause false positives. Now,
if I can stop you there, doctor. I think those were the four that you identified, the four limitations, the lactic acid,
If I could just go ask ahead you and few, ask your next question.
If I could ask you a few more questions about LDH and lactic acid.
Sure.
You're aware, Dr. Fowler, of the medical literature establishing that the presence of LDH and lactic acid can lead to falsely elevated serum readings, correct?
Correct.
And that's because lactic acid or LDH actually forms NADH.
Lactic acid, I'll have to go into a little bit of chemistry. Lactic acid and LDH, lactate dehydrogenase, they both act on each other. And LDH and lactic acid needs NAD plus to break it down. So in theory, when you're testing a serum, a plasma for blood alcohol, if there's extra LDH, or high levels of LDH, high levels of lactic acid, you add it to the test system, and then Roche throws in, or Siemens throws in, the NAD, it will form NADH. That was first documented, I think, back in the older versions of these ethanol testings, back in the 1990s. When they stumbled on, they were looking for biomarkers or reasons in kids with SIDS, little babies, and they found that two of these babies had a positive alcohol. But
doctor, if I could just ask the next question, if that's okay.
Sorry.
So in other words, NADH, studies have found, can actually be formed by certain biomechanical processes other than the presence of alcohol, right?
Yes.
Are you aware that the National Institute of Health has found that liver diseases, kidney diseases, muscle injury, trauma, and even anemia are some of the health conditions that can lead to a rise in serum LDH levels?
Yes.
Are you aware that Ms. Reed was severely anemic in January of 2022?
Sustained.
Are you aware that the medical literature has also found that patients suffering from multiple sclerosis have a twofold increase in NADH levels as compared to controls?
Objection. I'm going to allow that.
I haven't read anything specifically related to the NADH level, but I want to go back to the point where our laboratory, our testing is not based.
The question,
it's not
doctor,
let him finish his answer.
It's not. It's the rate of change of NADH. So if somebody has NADH on board, I believe it's not going to affect the result. It's the rate of change. Back to the anemia, I haven't read or heard of that.
That was stricken. That was
okay.
Not allowed.
It all goes back to the lactic acid and the LDH. The NAD... NADH doesn't matter. So looking at multiple sclerosis patients, they can have elevated LDH and lactic acid, but it's not to the extent that it can interfere with the alcohol levels. There was a study maybe 7-10 years ago.
Your Honor. There's no question pending.
You asked him about a study, if he was aware of the studies.
I asked, and that's a yes or no question. And he's...
All right, doctor, we're going to hold that there for you and ask the next question.
Doctor, have you reviewed the August 21st, 2013 peer-reviewed article entitled Serum NAD Through Disease Course in Multiple Sclerosis, which was sponsored by the Center of Healthy Brain Aging by the University of New South Wales.
Counsel, which, can you do that again and slow down, please?
Thank sure. You. Doctor, have you reviewed the August 21st, 2013 peer-reviewed article entitled Serum NAD Levels Through Disease Course in Multiple Sclerosis, which was sponsored by the Center for Healthy Brain Aging by the School of Psychiatry at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia, which specifically found that patients suffering from multiple sclerosis have a twofold increase in NADH levels as compared to controls.
Objection.
I'll strike the part of what the article held. Is he aware of the article?
No, I'm not, to be honest, no.
Dr. Fowler, did you consider Ms. Reed's anemia and multiple sclerosis condition when you conducted the alcohol test on January 29th, 2022?
No, we don't, no.
And again, serum tests like the ones conducted in this case don't test for ethanol, they only test for NADH, right?
We test for the rate of change of NADH production.
And Dr., you did a number of other tests on Ms. Reed on January 29th, 2022. You tested for additional drugs, not just alcohol, correct?
Correct.
And all of those results were negative?
Correct.
Thank you. No further questions.
Okay.
There's more live courtroom coverage coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a second from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.